Well, I'm just going to read a few verses from 2 Chronicles and chapter 6. 2 Chronicles chapter 6. Just reading verses 18 to 21. But will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this house that I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his plea, O Lord my God, listening to the cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you, that your eyes may be opened day and night towards this house, the place where you have promised to set your name, that you may listen to the prayer that your servant offers towards this place, and listen to the pleas of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray towards this place, and listen from heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. Well, I've no plans to do this, but I suppose one could preach an interesting sermon series looking at the Bible's iconic questions. God's question to Adam as he hides away in the bushes there following his disobedience, where are you? Isaac's question to his father Abraham as they climb that mountain together to offer a sacrifice at the top, where is the lamb? The angel's question to those women at the tomb where Jesus had lain, why do you seek the living among the dead? The jailer's question to Paul and Silas in the middle of the night following the earthquake, sirs, what must I do to be saved? Mary's question to the angel as she processes Gabriel's astonishing message, how can this be since I am a virgin? Those are some questions one might include in the series. And Solomon's, here in 2 Chronicles chapter 6 verse 18, though not perhaps quite as widely known, it, I think, would also be a contender. The question occurs within a prayer, but it's not really addressed to God. God is referred to in it in the third person, not in the second person, you. It's not really addressed to anyone. It's a rhetorical question. Will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? That's the question. Will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? And looking then at the paragraph introduced by that question, the paragraph I read to you just now, I want to notice two things. First of all, Solomon goes to town with an emphatic answer. Will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? No. No. That's Solomon's answer to the question. Now, we need to understand the context here. The context is that Solomon has just built a temple in the city of Jerusalem. For Israel, this is a groundbreaking development. Israel has never had a temple before. Solomon isn't the first person to think of it. His father David had conceived the idea and planned it all out. But Solomon has now actually built the thing. And it is then, as I say, a groundbreaking development in Israel's story. In world terms, however, it's not remotely groundbreaking. The world of Solomon's day is full of temples. Every self-respecting city has one. And while these temples then strewn across the ancient Near East are associated with different deities and feature different religious practices, there's one emphasis that is common to all of them, which is this. The temple is a divine dwelling place. The temple houses a God. Whatever the nation, whatever the religion, whatever the type of worship, that's just how temples work. Everyone knows it in the ancient world. It's as basic as 2 + 2 = 4. That where you have a temple, then by definition, you have a God's residence. And here in 2 Chronicles 6 then, as Solomon unveils his brand new temple, he can perceive exactly what the world is thinking. He knows how this will be reported on the TV channels and in the newspapers in Edom and Moab and Egypt. Israel finally has a temple for its God Yahweh to dwell in. And Solomon knows too that the Israelites aren't unaware of how temples work in the other nations, and that they could entertain the idea themselves that this building is actually God's dwelling place. They could think that's why it's so grand. That's why we've pulled out all the stops with our temple and made it huge and filled it with gold and the finest cedar wood. Because after all, it's a residence of the living and true God. It should therefore be superior to the residences of lifeless gods. He knows the Israelites could think like that. And that's why then in this very public prayer, it's prayed, we read in verse 13, in the presence of all the assembly of Israel, he asks this question: will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? He means, will God indeed dwell in this temple? Will God dwell in this architectural structure that I've put together, as the nations suppose that he will, and as you Israelites might possibly suppose that he will? And on an ordinary evening then, when you Israelites are sitting around in your houses because those are where you live, and I, the king, am sitting around in my palace because that's where I live, will God be sitting around in this temple that I've built? Because that's where he lives, because he belongs within its walls. That's where Solomon's question is coming from. And his answer then, as I said, is no. No. Contrary to the international media reports, contrary to the idea that might be passing through a few Israelite minds, this temple will not be providing Yahweh with accommodation. God will not be dwelling with man on the earth. And according to my heading then, Solomon doesn't just answer no, he goes to town and is emphatic in answering no. Why do I say that? Well, listen to Solomon. He says in the next part of the paragraph, behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this house that I have built. Do you see what he's saying there? Let me illustrate. Steve Bruce, the Newcastle football manager, doesn't live in my street. But he could do. You'd probably expect him to live somewhere a little bit fancier. But he could do. It's within the bounds of possibility. It just so happens, as a point of fact, that he doesn't. The Himalayas don't live in my street either. You can walk up Reynolds Avenue and back down again, and you won't find that mountain range there. But in this case, the situation is different, isn't it? Unlike Steve Bruce, the Himalayas couldn't possibly live in my street. They are way, way, way too big. And when Solomon says that God won't live in this temple then, it's not a Steve Bruce situation. It's not that he has simply chosen not to, for some reason. It's a Himalaya situation. He can't possibly live in this temple because he is way, way, way too big. In fact, the disparity between the Himalayas and Reynolds Avenue is actually quite modest compared to the disparity between God and Solomon's temple. At least the Himalayas can fit into the universe. They can fit into the universe very comfortably. They represent a mere speck within the universe. So that, yes, the idea of the Himalayas somehow squeezing into Reynolds Avenue may be bonkers, but in cosmic terms, it's actually just one little speck squeezing into one much, 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 much smaller little speck. But, say Solomon here, this is the thing with God. God can't fit into the universe even. Heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain him. This is bigness on a completely different scale. This universe that is big enough to hold 100 billion galaxies, each galaxy big enough to hold 100 billion stars, it isn't big enough to hold Israel's God. And so Solomon's no here to this question of God dwelling with man on the earth, it's not a tentative no, it's not a doubtful no, it's an emphatic no. He goes to town with this no. And I just want to pause then at that point and ask this morning, are you taking seriously this reality of God's massiveness? You know, this whole idea that so dominated the ancient world, this idea of God dwelling in a temple building, it had a certain appeal to ancient people. Because a God who dwelt in a temple building was a God you were in control of. When you wanted a bit of that God in your life, then you went to the temple and you had your session, and then you came out of the temple and you left that God behind and you got on with your life again. You were in control of the whole thing. And I have a feeling that many people today erect temples for the Christian God, for the God of the Bible, to live in. Not temples of bricks and mortar, but temples that kind of keep God safely housed, where we can go to him when we want a bit of him in our lives. I have a feeling Christmas functions like that for many people. Christmas is one of those temples. And for 50 weeks of the year, folk live virtually without reference to God. And then for a couple of weeks in December, they, as it were, go along to the temple, have a bit of God in their lives. And then it's January and he's left behind once again. Perhaps you're in that category. And Solomon is saying to us then, look, this God is way too huge for that. My temple cannot contain him. Christmas cannot contain him. The universe cannot contain him. Don't try to keep him under control. Yield rather to his control of you. Don't try to bring him into your life every now and again, but bring your life to him in its entirety, that he might rule it and possess it and use it for his glory, because he is this colossal, transcendent, uncontainable, universe-dwarfing God. That's what Solomon is saying to us. Will you listen this morning? So that's the first thing then. Solomon goes to town with an emphatic answer. But then secondly, I want you to notice, Solomon sows the seeds of a deeper answer. Solomon sows the seeds of a deeper answer. So Solomon is clearly convinced then of God's bigness. But his understanding of God isn't confined to that one notion. It includes other emphases that might seem at odds actually with this idea of God's bigness. It might seem natural to assume that a God who is so immense, as Solomon is describing him, is inaccessible, that we can have no meaningful relationship with him. It's just not possible, given the gulf between this one who can't fit himself into the cosmos and us, its microscopic inhabitants. But Solomon will have none of that. Despite being so emphatic about God's dizzying dimensions, he insists that God is accessible. There's a particular word he keeps using. It's the word listen. Four times in the space of three verses, verses 19 to 21, he refers to God listening. Indeed, that, he says, is where this temple comes in. This building that he has erected, it isn't God's dwelling place. But it is the means God has appointed for accessing him. Consider our English noun address. And we tend to think, don't we, that my address is the place where I live. But strictly speaking, when someone asks you for your address, they're not asking where you live, they're asking where they may address you, where they may access you in the form of a letter. Whether or not you actually live there is beside the point. And this temple that Solomon has built is going to be God's address in that sense. Not that he will live there. As we said, no temple, no created thing at all could possibly house him. But the temple is where the Israelites may address him, where they may access him in the form of prayer. They may pray, as it says twice in this paragraph, towards this place, the way Daniel did, you remember, in far off Persia. And God then, despite being so transcendent and so other, God will listen. Solomon is convinced of God's bigness, but he's equally convinced that this big God listens. Listens to what? Well, we said just now, prayer. So, expressions of adoration and thanksgiving then? Well, yes, but that's not what Solomon has in mind here. The word he uses is please. Verse 21, listen to the pleas of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray towards this place. Please, that is earnest, humble requests. Please for what? At first sight, Solomon doesn't seem to specify, but actually he does, because he says, listen to the pleas of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray towards this place, and listen from heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. Forgive. Where does that word suddenly come from? Well, presumably the pleas that Solomon has in mind are pleas for pardon, pleas for forgiveness. And Solomon is saying then that this huge God, far from being inaccessible, as we might imagine, he's a God who listens to pleas for pardon. Or to put it another way, he's a God who is willing to forgive sins. You know, sometimes we say things not realizing the trajectory of the words we are speaking. It may not have been like this at all, but imagine when little Roger was 5 or 6 years old, perhaps, and one day Mr. and Mrs. Federer were sitting at their kitchen table having a cup of coffee, and Mr. Federer just casually commented, oh, I've seen some tennis lessons advertised at the park just around the corner there. Might send him along. It'd be good for him to have some fresh air and get a run around. Well, if such a scene did occur many years ago in the Federer house, I think it's fair to say that Mr. Federer didn't realise the mind-blowing trajectory of his apparently banal words. That the upshot of little Roger going along to those tennis lessons would be trophies and global fame and eye-watering prize money and a notable place in the annals of sporting history. He had no idea. And when Solomon speaks here of God's willingness to forgive sins, I'm not saying that they are throwaway remarks. He knows that God is a holy, sin-hating God and that his willingness to forgive, therefore, isn't to be taken for granted. It's a big deal. I'm not saying that these are banal remarks in the same way that Mr. Federer's about the advertisement on the park fence were in my imagined scenario. But I would put it to you this morning that like Mr. Federer, Solomon did not realize the mind-blowing trajectory of these words. He didn't realize the upshot of God's willingness to forgive. He didn't realize where that willingness to forgive would lead. He didn't realize that that willingness to forgive would lead ultimately to the very thing Solomon is so emphatic cannot possibly happen. It would lead to God dwelling with man on the earth. Indeed, God dwelling with man on the earth in an even more outrageous manner than the one that Solomon cannot stomach. Solomon cannot stomach the idea of the uncontainable God squeezing into his palatial temple. The fact is, God will one day squeeze into Solomon's very family, into his very genealogy. He will become Solomon's own kin, Solomon's descendant, Jesus, the son of David, all because he's a God willing to forgive sins. You see, Solomon understood very clearly the manifold inabilities of a God who dwells with man on the earth in the pagan sense. A God housed within a building. Such a God is comprehensively unable. Unable to create, unable to provide, unable to interact, unable to do anything. Solomon understood the manifold inabilities of a God who dwells on earth. And that's no small thing that he understood that in the context of the ancient world. But Solomon did not understand that a God who dwells in heaven also has one major inability. Yes, he can create and provide and interact and all those kinds of things. But there's one thing he can't do. He can't forgive. He can't forgive his creature's sins. Not properly anyway. Not satisfactorily. Only a God who enters into his creation and takes to himself the very nature, the very makeup of those who have committed the sins, and in that human nature is punished for those sins as their substitute. Only such a God can truly dispense forgiveness. Solomon didn't understand that. And so he speaks here of God's willingness to forgive. And in doing so, I'm saying, he's unwittingly sowing the seeds of a deeper answer to his question, will God indeed dwell with man on the earth? Because if Solomon is right that God really is willing to forgive, if Solomon is right that God is one who really will listen to the pleas of guilty sinners wanting pardon for their offenses, if Solomon is right on those points, then although he doesn't yet appreciate it, the answer to his question must ultimately be yes. God will indeed dwell with man on the earth. And I just want to challenge you then with two appropriate responses to that as we close. Response number one, let's be filled with wonder. Let's be filled with wonder. What a thing it is that sure enough, many centuries after Solomon, God dwelt with man on the earth. God dwelt with man on the earth. Think about it. Solomon says here that the universe is too small for him. And yet for 9 months, the uterus of young Mary of Nazareth comfortably contains him. Here's Solomon on his knees, according to verse 13, his arms spread out, crying out to God in trembling awe, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. And yet a time will come when that same God, incarnated in the person of Jesus, will regularly toddle up to his mother, climb on her knee and say, "Mummy, tell me some stories about great King Solomon." It's mind-boggling, isn't it? It should cause goosebumps to break out on our skin. Our society gets excited about a bunch of celebrities spending a few weeks in an artificial jungle. Here's something that should really excite and amaze us. God dwelt with man on the earth. Let's be filled with wonder. And then response number two, let's make sure we have God's forgiveness this morning. Let's make sure we have God's forgiveness this morning. If he went to such lengths to be able to dispense it, if he redefined what, according to wise King Solomon, is even possible, if he did something that makes the relocating of the Himalayan mountains to Reynolds Avenue seem quite sane by comparison, if he went to such lengths to be able to dispense forgiveness, then forgiveness must be really, really necessary. It must be the difference between hell and heaven, the difference between everlasting misery and everlasting joy. Do you have it? Have you been to God for it? If not, go and don't delay a moment longer. Let's make sure we're enjoying this morning, this forgiveness that God is so willing to extend to sinners like us, that once he did the unthinkable, the inconceivable, the unfathomable, he dwelt with man on the earth. Amen.